Oyez, 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 the Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. We welcome ourselves and you to the newly refurbished courtroom of the Supreme Court of Texas. Justice Gamage is out of town at a funeral, but he will participate in the deliberation and decision in this cause. This morning, the court has one cause on its oral argument docket. That is the cause of Sylvester Turner versus the First Court of Appeal, an original mandamus proceeding. The court has allotted 15 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The relator may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by so advising the marshal of our court. The court is ready to hear argument from the relator.
May it please the court, Mr. Sylvester Turner will present argument for the relator. He will reserve up to 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Chief Justice, may it please the court. On this one, there are two basic areas that I want to highlight today. The first is that with respect to the trial court itself, that there was not a clear abuse of discretion. And secondly, that the relator below had an adequate remedy. I think it's important since in this particular case, you are being asked to serve pretty much as a trial court and looking at what was done below. It's important to note that in the record, the trial court noted certain things. He indicated, and if you would allow me to speak in the first person in this particular matter, that Sylvester Turner was not resisting discovery, and that was his finding below, but this was not a hide-and-seek matter. He also indicated a second thing, and that was that there was a substantial amount of discovery that was provided by Sylvester Turner, by myself. That is what the trial court's finding, and is clearly in the record itself. Of the 39 requests for production, the other side only takes issue with 14 of the 39. And of that 14, six of them, only six, were not answered or responded to because of attorney-client privilege, Enos versus Baker. The other eight, were not responded to in part either because they were vague or unclear or were global in nature. All the documents themselves were provided. So there are only six of the 39 requests for productions where no documents were responded to simply because of an attorney-client privilege on Enos versus Baker.
Are the documents in our record?
The documents are there. Most of them are there.
In our record?
In your record. They were filed. Also, it is important to know that the other side stipulated that for many of the documents that were not produced, that those documents were not produced or undiscoverable because of Enos versus Baker. That is what the other side stipulated to as it relates to Judge Montgomery, the trial court, down below. The question that I believe this court should strongly consider is whether or not by stipulation of the law and its application to the discovery request, can a party allege an abuse of discretion and seek a conditional writ of mandamus. In essence, if the other side agrees with the trial court judge, with the trial court, that these are matters that are undiscoverable because of the law. And if the judge were to apply the law or grant that discovery, that he will be going against what the prevailing law was at the time, can that party then turn around and seek a writ of mandamus because the judge did not follow something that was stipulated to about down below?
Mr. Turner, so you would say that in addition to submitting an affidavit to establish a privilege, or providing oral testimony at the time of hearing, the parties can merely stipulate that the privilege is controlled by a case, in this instance, Enos versus Baker, and preserve the privilege. Is that true?
And that is correct. And what happened in this particular case is at the trial court level, when Judge Montgomery had a hearing, both sides agreed that for many of the documents that were not put forth or were not produced, that those documents were not produced because of Enos versus Baker. There was no disagreement there. And so if Judge Montgomery had ordered documents to be produced, all sides agreed that he would be going against what was the prevailing law at the time. That was by way of stipulation. And so the question now is, can a party turn around after agreeing to that stipulation and issue or request a conditional writ of mandamus? I believe that that would be contrary to everything that we subscribe to. Now, the relator below, the other side, disapproved of Enos versus Baker. There is no question when you look at the record that they believe that Enos versus Baker was bad law based on bad facts. And so they attack Enos versus Baker from the very beginning. But the second question arises is, even if you disagree with a case that was decided by the appellate court, does that entitle you to an interlocutory appeal at that point in time or writ of mandamus? Or should you argue that through the normal appellate process? In essence, if we agree that if the appellate court decides something and we believe that the law is wrong based on bad facts, can we stop where we are at the trial court level and seek a writ of mandamus and then try to reverse that law, or should we wait and go through the normal appellate process? What the other side is seeking to do today is circumvent the normal appellate process. They are asking this court to reverse or overturn Enos versus Baker. And so this is not an issue where a party is not trying to meet the request for production, or a party is intentionally trying to subvert the discovery process. This is a situation in which a party disagrees with what the law is and is asking this court to overturn itself or to overturn Enos versus Baker. And I would submit to you, just as Judge Montgomery was compelled to follow Enos versus Baker, so was the First Court of Appeals compelled to follow Walker versus Packer, that it did not have the right to simply place it to the side and not look at it and make its decision accordingly. If you look at what was done, what was presented, there was no privilege information at stake. The only privilege information that is at stake is right here, that if this conditional writ of mandamus is not withdrawn, then attorney-client files are being asked to be submitted. But down below, there was no privilege information. The claim would not have been vituated or severely compromised if Judge Montgomery's order had stood. No one argued, in a sense, that Cheryl Turner would not have had the right to evaluate my law firm had the documents that were submitted been looked at very carefully. And thirdly, the missing records, there was no issue as to missing records and whether or not that they would be available on appeal. Now, a third question is, can the value of the firm, of a law firm, be ascertained based upon the information that was submitted? And I would submit to you that it is important to note this is a partnership, not a corporation. And so whether or not the firm puts forth, a partner receives income, or whether or not that income remains in the partnership, all of that flows through. And so were income tax returns submitted? The answer is yes. Were deposit slips and counsel checks submitted? The answer is yes. Were CD information all submitted? The answer is yes. Were firm statement of income submitted? Partnership agreements, buy-sell agreements, K-1s? Yes. Pension retirement information? All of that information, Judge Montgomery concluded, was submitted, and one could adequately evaluate the value of a law firm. This was a general partnership, not a corporation. So whether or not a firm has X amount in a firm check account, or whether or not that amount is forwarded to the individual partner, is irrelevant. For income tax purposes, it still must be reflected on one's income tax returns. And so all of the financial information, as it relates to me personally or as it relates to the law firm, that information was submitted. And furthermore, Judge Montgomery obtained a stipulation that all of that information would be updated, and all sides agreed to that. The only issue in this writ of mandamus is whether or not a person should be compelled to turn over client's files.
Without proof or showing that they actually are privileged. That's the issue.
Well, the issue is in Enos versus Baker, it talks about active client files. And it says if there are less invasive ways of evaluating the law firm,
then we should turn to those less invasive ways. And
but here there has been no showing that the documents actually are privileged in the trial court.
Well, no showing because the other side stipulated down below that the documents were governed by Ennis versus Baker. Now, had the other side not stipulated to that and took issue with the trial court, then that would be a different issue. Even if you don't like what happened down below, you cannot overlook the fact that that was a stipulation by the other side. They stipulated that what Judge Montgomery did of the documents that were not produced were governed by Ennis versus Baker.
Does the request itself show that what it's seeking is governed by Ennis v. Baker? Does the request that was made to you for discovery of these documents, does it show on its face by the nature of the request that it's seeking these active client files that would be subject to Ennis v. Baker?
In request number 32, it is clear that they are seeking the client's files. Because with respect to everything else, the financial information of the person as well as of the law firm, those things were acquiesced to. I did not take issue with financial information.
Does it follow from your position that if a position were being, were in a divorce proceeding and request was made for production of his patient files, you could follow the same procedures that you have in this case and not produce those files?
I think one could follow suit. That would follow suit. And so when you look at the information that was presented, one can adequately evaluate the value of a person's law firm. And so, and even if this court disagreed, instead of standing by the conditional writ of mandamus, the best route would be to take it back, to send it back to Judge Montgomery and ask him by an in-camera inspection to look at the documents themselves and make a decision. But I think it would set a bad precedent for this court, based on the stipulation and based on the facts presented, to now to place itself as a trial judge in every situation. It opens up the door, and it strikes, the case that strikes directly at Walker versus Packer. And this court must decide whether or not it intends, in a year's time or less, to reverse course. And is this a situation that deserves this court turning around from a decision that was recently made? I do not believe that the facts as they presented warrant that situation.
Mr. Turner, what do you understand from the Court of Appeals, assuming that their decision stands, what do you understand you are to produce?
It is my understanding that I am to produce every one of my client files.
And not just simply information that may be contained in those files.
They issued a carte blanche order that there was a conditional writ of maintenance, and I am to submit all of my client's files. I assume the right to read that, the names or anything else that may pertain to the client. But I think it's important to know that even if they argue that I waived an attorney-client privilege, the clients themselves did not waive that. And that remains on board. And the only issue is trying to evaluate the value of the firm. And if the information submitted, if that can be done without going to that intrusive measure, then both parties have received what they're entitled to.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court. Joel Nash will present argument.
May it please the justices of this honorable court, my name is Joel Nash. I represent Cheryl Turner, the respondent and real party in interest in this matter. If it were not a fact that the relationship of the issues between Rule 503, the Texas Rules, Civil Evidence, case filed Ennis versus Baker, and Cheryl Turner versus the Honorable Judge John Montgomery were so critical to the fundamental constitution and statutory property rights of these parties, then the issues surrounding Enos versus Baker and now the action before this court may be dismissed as only interesting academic conversation or philosophical conversation, because the technical aspects of these cases are interesting and academic. But in the real world, as a trial lawyer practicing law in the state of Texas in divorce-related matters, the importance of these issues must not be understated.
Do you agree with Mr. Turner that the only reason we're here is because you disagree with Enos versus Baker as law, or
no, sir.
Is there some other reason we're here?
At the trial level, it was argued that Enos versus Baker was not applicable to the facts of this case, Cheryl Turner versus Sylvester Turner. Mr. Turner took the position in his discovery responses presented to answers to questions provided by us under Rule 166 of Texas Rules of Procedure, that virtually all of the requested documents and information were protected by the attorney-client privilege, and he cited the case Enos versus Baker. We believe that the Court of Appeals may have taken a stronger position with regard to Enos versus Baker. I will agree with that. The Court of Appeals took a position that a waiver of the objection, because there was no in-camera production, or the documents that were not produced at the time that the discovery was sought, was a waiver of his rights. And I feel that that dilutes the true issue. Although we agree that the technical requirements of the rules were not complied with, we believe that the actual Enos Baker issue, that is the right of a party to seek relief under Section 3.63 of the Texas Family Code, is a substantial property right. And Enos versus Baker has created a dramatic and critical change to the way that family cases shall proceed, because it has now created a roadblock or an obstacle to the authority of the trial court to divide property in a fair, just, and right division.
So you agree with Mr. Turner that all parties agree that Enos versus Baker was the controlling case, or at least the only reported appellate case in Texas on this subject, and so everybody knew that what Mr. Turner was urging was an attorney-client privilege to the production of these files.
Yes, sir. My only addition to that would be that there was no stipulation that Cheryl Turner waived any right, because we proceeded, as Justice Montgomery conducted the trial, based upon primarily that objection with regard to those specific questions, which are set out in the motion to compel, which is of record.
Well, even if she didn't waive it, though, how can it be an abuse of discretion for Judge Montgomery to follow the only controlling law in the area?
Well, as the Court of Appeals found, Enos versus Baker can be distinguished from this case. Enos Baker was a case that was decided because Judge Baker, on his own motion, ordered all of these records and all of these files dumped upon counsel for the wife. And Mr. Enos objected to that. But it's interesting to note that as part of his objections, at the end, he didn't mind that she had them as long as they were protected and sealed. The Court of Appeals in this case distinguished by saying that there was a proper motion for production. There was a waiver of the privilege because none of the documents were produced in camera. None of the documents were produced pursuant to the rule. And then the court found that In spite of that, Cheryl Turner would not have the opportunity or the property right to fairly value the major asset in this estate, because contrary to what Mr. Turner has stated to you, I asked the court to look to the records, there were no records that were provided that would allow a fair shot that Cheryl Turner would have to value the estate.
Is there any doubt that at least some of these records are privileged?
Some of these records may be privileged. We certainly do not stand before you and say that the attorney-client privilege is not the age-old and properly evidentiary protection of clients represented by lawyers. That's not the issue. That is why we ask for special dispensation, if you will, by asking the court to redact names. In our motion, we ask for several methods to protect the client relationship. The horrible tragedy of Enos versus Baker, in my opinion, is this. People are now coming in at the trial court level and saying, we're not going to produce a single document or record because of Enos versus Baker. And the attorney-client privilege, in our opinion, was not legislated or has been enforced like that for years and years and years. There have been safeguards within Rule 503 that have allowed parties to obtain information. That is not happening now.
But even the redaction of clients' names in an ordinary lawyer's file would be a significant process, a significant undertaking. Go through each pleading and each letter and each fee statement and redact names and identifying information.
That may be true, Judge, and in some cases, and I would suggest in this case, that is not true with a solo practitioner. And you can make the same argument that it could be voluminous with regard to other areas. But in truth and in fact, on a daily basis, doctors and other individuals with client relationships, confidential relationships, have their practice valued for purposes of division of divorce. On a daily basis in our community, banks and lawyers enter into relationships like lines of credit where certain case information is provided to them voluntarily to obtain the lawyer's businesses to proceed while they're financing cases. In probate matters, in partnership dissolution matters, these types of issues are dealt with on a regular basis. 503 is being used as a weapon against Cheryl Turner.
Is it your contention that the only means that Ms. Turner has to determine what the divisible community estate is in this instance is by compelling production of Mr. Turner's client's files? Or are there alternative means by which that evaluation could occur?
There are certainly alternative means, and those were the means that we had suggested to Judge Montgomery before he issued his final ruling in the motion to compel, denying us in-camera inspection, denying redaction, denying special discovery masters, denying all of those things that courts have been using for long periods of time to obtain this kind of information to value an estate in spite of Rule 503 in the important privilege, the attorney-client privilege.
Are you, I guess I go back to my question to Ms. Turner, do you agree with Ms. Turner that you, in your discovery request, have asked for the client files?
I believe we have asked for client files. Yes. Now, I would suggest to the court that in the Court of Appeals opinion.
So your agreement is, if your agreement at least is that the controlling law apparently is Enos versus Baker, and either it's distinguishable because Mr. Turner had an opportunity for a hearing, in which event he didn't meet his burden to establish his right to protect them, or if he did, then we meet head-on whether or not Enos versus Baker ought to be controlling law in this state.
Yes, sir. Of other significant note, Enos Baker sets out certain records that shall be produced that would not be subject to the privilege. In this case, Mr. Turner did not provide documents such as pay stubs, accounts receivable, copies of business agreements and contracts, journals, ledger entries, accounts receivables, diaries, contracts, settlement letters, agreements of promise to pay, receivables. He produced none of those records arguing Enos versus Baker.
What did he provide?
He didn't.
What financial information with regard to the partnership did he provide?
To my recollection, Judge, he provided a partnership agreement and precious little else.
No financial data?
No, sir.
Are the documents that we're arguing over in our record?
Yes, sir.
The client files?
Yes, sir. Now, subsequent to the Court of Appeals ruling, Judge Montgomery has ordered some documents to be provided to him in camera. Those documents I have not seen. It has not been Cheryl Turner's intention, nor her, have we filed any motions or actions to try to obtain the full breadth of what Mr. Turner has suggested may be possible, which is that we have carte blanche access to all of those files and all of that information. All Cheryl Turner is seeking is a fair opportunity to value the most valuable asset in the community estate. And it's not solely, might I say, for purposes of division of property, but as this court well knows, the child support guidelines in other matters promulgated require that there be certain information by which to determine net resources. There is simply no way to verify net resources in this kind of a case when a party has the opportunity to dictate only those records that they see the opposing party to see and simply stated, we don't have any other records that he, Mr. Turner, has not wanted us to see. Mrs. Turner may go to each and every county seat in court in this state to try to obtain public information, files on record, to determine if Mr. Turner is representing a client. As a matter of fact, we have done that in Harris County, and we have determined, as a matter of public record, he is attorney of record in many cases.
I know you're running out of time. Assuming that we meet Enos versus Baker head on, then a question. Can an attorney, in an unrelated matter, waive a client's attorney-client privilege? If I hire a lawyer to represent me in this matter, and that lawyer is my agent, and the lawyer messes up, and I lose my attorney-client privilege, and I've got a claim against that lawyer, but what happens when I have no idea that my lawyer is involved in his own personal matters, and it's unrelated as to that lawyer's actions in my case. How do we grapple with an attorney who waives an attorney-client privilege when it's really the client's to assert, the client has no notice that anything's going on and no opportunity to protect the client?
Justice Ian, I would say that when a client seeks legal representation, he has a certain expectation of what information is to be confidential. There are certainly many aspects of my representing a client which are not intended to be a confidential communication. Certainly, the fees that would be paid to me as a lawyer would not necessarily be a confidential communication that would in any way alienate an attorney-client relationship or interfere with an attorney-client relationship. The Court of Appeals cited a case called Borden, Inc. versus Valdez. In that case, where the privilege was asserted,
wouldn't we be talking about no privilege in the first place? I mean, I'm not talking about items that would not, under the traditional sense, be considered privileged information. But I'm talking about privileged information that would get disclosed if you just turned over client files.
If I may conclude with my time expired to that question.
In the Borden case, there were 77,000 documents. There were maybe 9 documents that were excluded because of privilege and a few more that were excluded based on relevancy. To completely deny a party the opportunity to their constitutional property right, a fair, just, and right division based on the speculative nature of what may or may not be privileged, we believe is a conflict between statutory mandate in an evidentiary rule. Although an important evidentiary rule, Cheryl Turner has no other remedy to obtain a valuation of primary property. The special discovery master or in-camera inspection would be a way to determine what you are asking.
At most, you contend that the trial court erred in failing to conduct an in-camera inspection. Or do you claim that the privilege has been waived outright and you're entitled to documents? I thought I heard you say that you thought Judge Montgomery should have had an in-camera inspection. And in fact, I think you said that since the Court of Appeals opinion came down, he has modified his order and ordered in-camera inspection of some documents?
Yes, sir. Justice Cornyn, I would say this. There is a place for Rule 503, attorney-client privilege rule, and Rule 3.63 of the Texas Family Code to peacefully coexist. And I agree with you entirely that there is, and as I suggested to Judge Montgomery and have requested in motions filed as part of the record of this case, that would have been the way to satisfy Mr. Turner's concerns, his client's concerns, still provide Cheryl Turner a fair access to her community property. That would have been the easiest and the simplest way to proceed.
Let me ask a practical question. How long does it take for most a state of this size, most community states, to resolve themselves through the divorce court? Well, my question is leading is that it seems like a lot of these cases would be settling. Although I suppose as new cases come in, as long as they're still married, they are part of the community property.
I'm not sure that I understand your question.
Well, I guess I may have answered it myself. But I think most of the cases that Mr. Turner had in his office at the time that this divorce was brought are going to be resolved. Or at least they'll be to a point where they can be evaluated within a few years. I would think once you have a trial and a verdict, even if that's on appeal, there's enough of a public record there that an appropriate evaluation could be put on that case. Once the case is settled, it's just that the amounts come into those records that would clearly be discoverable. But I assume the problem is new cases are coming in all the time until the divorce.
Mr. Turner has settled a number of cases which are clearly a community property right, in those cases are providing to him structured settlement payments. We have not been provided a document which indicates what that structured property payment is. That is potentially and clearly is income to the community to the extent that he receives it.
Have you been provided information with regards to a global amount that the partnership will be receiving a certain?
No, sir. And what it requires Cheryl Turner to do, as I was suggesting earlier, is to go open up sealed files, to go to every county in the state of Texas or the country, if it may be, to try to get public disclosure of information, which we feel is totally contrary to the intent of Rule 166, to provide access to records. She may have to file interventions in all of those cases to alert insurance companies, claimants, parties that she has a property right. And we are now looking at global litigation, unnecessarily.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Turner, would you respond to the statement Mr. Mass made that you provided a copy of the partnership agreement and nothing else with regards to financial data, have no financial data?
And, Your Honor, let me take strong issue with that, and I think the record will speak to itself. In terms of what has been provided, you will see within the brief itself and the exhibits that have been attached, as well as the hearing at the time with Judge Montgomery, that we have provided firm balance sheets, firm statement of income, partnership agreements, buy-sell agreements, firm K-1s, pension retirement information, insurance data, and Judge Montgomery has ordered us to make sure that all of that information is updated. That is the information that has all been provided, and we are under an order to make sure that those information is made current.
With regards to agreement that you have made, perhaps in some personal injury cases, your firm will be receiving income as a result of structured settlement. As I understand, Mr. Nass, he said that they are not have not been able to get from you, or from your law firm, the amount the firm would be receiving as a fee, as compensation.
And the reason for that, again, that falls on the request number 32, which is governed by Ennis versus Baker. But one thing is clear. If a structured settlement amount is received, for example, in 1991, that amount falls under the income tax returns. This is a partnership and not a corporation. So even though Mr. Nash may not get the specific data as it relates to a structured settlement amount, because any amount that remains within the confines of the firm flows through directly to the partners. And to the extent income tax returns are made available, then he had a clear indication of what Sylvester Turner of the firm is worth. And by providing the K-1s, it allows you to see exactly what the firm has. So when you look at the balance sheets, the financial statements, the K-1s, the pension retirements, the buy-sell agreements, all of that information is enough to be able to ascertain the value of the law firm. Because that's the issue. The issue is not how much income is being derived. The issue is what is the value of the firm. And so what does it mean if you're receiving, for example, $200,000 a year and your liabilities are $210,000? It doesn't provide you with anything. What you're trying to get to is the value. What is the value of the firm? And Judge Montgomery found with the information that was being provided, and he ordered that the financial information of me personally, as well as the firm, must be provided, and you redact anything that pertains to clients. That's in the order. That's what we are governed by. Let me also bring attention to the court that this is a conditional writ of mandamus. That's why we are here. The danger when we allow matters of this kind to come before this court is that it does a disservice to the parties that are directly involved. Cheryl and Sylvester Turner are done a disservice because while other parties argue what the law is or should be, attorney's fees are being expended, and the whole matter is continued. So when we talk about property rights, there are property rights on both sides. When this court allows writs of mandamus to come in this fashion, then we lose out. The only issue is whether or not
your time is expired. So let me see if there are any questions. Are there any further questions?
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. That concludes the arguments in the foregoing cause, and this cause is submitted on briefs and oral arguments. The marshal will now please adjourn the court.
Judge, please rise. Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now standing.